think percentage-wise, it's very likely that the market share of 4G Ether products is substantially larger and bigger than the market share for physical products. I think that's a future that is unavoidable, and we know it. Just like, you know, 30 years ago, all of the biggest companies in the world were all oil companies, and today all the biggest companies in the world are tech companies.
Welcome to the Interline podcast. This is episode 4, and we're here to talk about the foundations of metaverse fashion. There's a lot of metaverse content out there approaching the subject from a lot of different angles, and some of them are frankly pretty dubious. You might have seen that we recently kickstarted a new series of articles written by the Digital Fashion Group as part of a new content partnership, and those are targeted at making sense of the metaverse. And that's part of an overall trend, because there's a strong inclination out there right now for people to treat the metaverse as something that's finished and ready to go, something we all implicitly agree the shape of, something that's framed as being a commercial opportunity first and a cultural upheaval second. I don't think any of that's the case, but luckily there does also seem to be a growing realization in the industry that, with the initial hype wave dying down, the task has turned to asking and answering some hard questions and to recognizing that there are multiple new business models to be made, but they're going to need to be made on a more realistic timeline. To tackle some of those hard questions, I have one guest for this show, Marjorie Hernandez. Marjorie is the founder of Luxo, which is billed as an open and interoperable blueprint for digital and digital worlds. The Interline and Luxo collaborated on a manifesto for how brands can stake their claim in the new digital economy back in 2020. And things have moved quickly in this space, and the word metaverse wasn't as prominent in the public consciousness when we wrote that piece as it is today. But there's still a lot that's relevant in there, so you'll find a link to that piece in this episode's description. Marjorie is also a co-founder of The Dematerialized, a Web3 marketplace for authenticated virtual goods and a platform for nurturing the emerging digital fashion ecosystem. All of which gives her a unique perspective on not just the possibility space of digital fashion, but some of the core mechanics of digital ownership and decentralization. We're going to be tackling both of those topics in this episode, but first, some exciting news. This episode of the Interline podcast is sponsored by Informer Markets Fashion and Sourcing at Magic, the milestone fashion sourcing event that's been a fixture in the calendars of international brands, manufacturers, suppliers, and service providers for years. This August 7th through 10th, the Interline is extremely proud to be partnering with the team behind Sourcing at Magic to extend the technology footprint of its Las Vegas show, bringing vital fashion industry discussions like the one you'll hear in this episode to life, along with a wider program of tech-focused talks, topic breakdowns, and demonstrations by technology exhibitors. That's all going to be collected in a new tech-first community called the Source Lounge. It'll all be free to attend for anyone who's already going to Sourcing at Magic, and I'm going to be personally curating and hosting all the sessions, so they're guaranteed to be your kind of content if you're already a fan of the Interline, and especially if you enjoy this episode. You can find out more and register to attend or exhibit at www.sourcingatmagic.com. We'll also be recording a special episode of the podcast at the event, so even if you can't make it, that should help it feel as though you're there. I'm really excited to be partnering with Sourcing at Magic for the show in a few weeks' time, as well as for future Informer Markets fashion events in North America. Like everyone here at the Interline, they believe that everyone who works in fashion will have their role touched by technology in the near future. And like us, they believe it's important to make sure everyone's informed about how to make technology work for them. So come and see fashion technology in action this August 7th through 10th at the Las Vegas Convention Center. And check out the new editorial collaboration between the Interline and the Sourcing at Magic team live on the website now. Now back to my discussion with Marjorie. Marjorie, it's kind of difficult to avoid the word metaverse at the moment because everyone has their own slant on what that means. Everyone's got their own vision for what that describes. I'd like to get your perspective on some of the more foundational bits of that, you know, digital ownership, interoperability, the ability to sort of verifiably own a digital garment and then to use it wherever you like in one or more metaverses, if that's the way things go. That's also kind of one of the core building blocks of any long-term view for digital interactive fashion. But it's also kind of one of the pieces that people seem keen to sort of hand wave away as being a concern for the future. People seem very keen to run at the idea that, okay, we're targeting the metaverse, we'll figure out what it means to actually verifiably own something and move it around and port it afterwards. What's your perspective on that way of thinking? What's your perspective on how far that vision for digital ownership is being realized today? And what's currently missing from that picture?
the point where I would like to start is that we are just at the beginning of a step in between kind of like two versions of, let's call it the web for now. And we're just in the beginning of the next iteration. And what that means and what that will mean long-term is yet to be defined. I think we all collectively, all of us who are working in the space, have a sense of the direction that it's going to take. So in my personal opinion, I think number one, there's not such a thing as metaverses. Just in the same way we don't have internets, we have potentially it's going to, I think the definition of the metaverse is to one place, and not because it's going to be one place of experience, but because what constitutes the metaverse is all of those different pieces coming together. So I think there's a heavily mixed use of the word metaverse, in which it could create some kind of confusion for things that we already know since a very long time, like games. Right? Like games exist for a very long time. So the metaverse is not a game, but games are part of the metaverse. So I think all of those things coming together constitute this next iteration of the web. And that implies a real juxtaposition between the digital reality and the physical reality. And then that's that juxtaposition that is being created by the advance of technology, between computer graphics and, you know, bandwidth and all of those things coming together to really allow for a juxtaposition, and the fact that we're going to be constantly immersed in the next iteration of devices that we're going to have, which obviously is going to be way more sophisticated than our current smartphones, are going to allow for a full immersion. The parts that are really important to go back to kind of like your question is definitely in terms of ownership. If we are spending even more and more time, or our reality is truly juxtaposed with digital reality, then things like our ownership, our identity, our assets, the way we're spending our money and our time has to be fundamentally modified. I think the current business model of the web was kind of like a byproduct in kind of like an effort to try to monetize the internet, because there was not clear business model from the get-go. So all of a sudden, advertisement and user data became the business model. And I think that was fine. We got a lot of services for free. That was a between stepping stone, but now we have to move ahead. And then in that process of moving ahead, there is the fact that we need to own our profiles. We need to own our identity. We need to be able, once we buy an asset, we should own it, and it should not be on control of the provider of the asset. And then that asset should be able, or should in all cases, grant us access to all different spaces of experience. So I think when people nowadays say I'm building a metaverse, I think what they mean is that you're just building a place for experience, right? Which is primarily digital. So that might be some kind of like gamified experience, that might be something like a layer with social media, things like that. So I think, you know, in that part of modifying, there's a lot of like technological pieces that need to be build and construct. And then in terms of a community, people need to start coming together and agreeing what are the pieces that make the most sense. And then keeping an eye and being very cautious in terms like centralization. In this case, it is truly, truly dangerous, because still today, most of us, we make a living or we exist within without the access for, like, that has not so much impact in our livelihood if we have or have not access to digital technologies. Of course, it is better, but if you're an influencer or, you know, a content creator, things like that, your livelihood is really, you know, depending on your access to these platforms. And these platforms, as privately owned companies, they have the ability to blacklist, whitelist, stop people from accessing, cancel you, or whatever it is the name they were giving it. So there is a danger that comes attached to that. If you're main occupation, if your livelihood is attached to the ability of entering a space, your ability of selling your assets, your products, of having your identity as a creator existing in a digital environment, then we have to make sure that those things do not exist within a centralized system that is controlled by incentives of a group of shareholders. So I think in that term, it represents kind of like a very big kind of like change.
Yeah, and I'd absolutely agree with that. And I think
it also makes you subject to the whims of platform owners as well. So it's very, you know, it's important to realize that everybody who's been, if you've ever been a YouTube creator, developed a video game, you've been beholden to the whims of publishers or platform owners, any of those kinds of things. Those things are subject to change based on, like you said, commercial factors, commercial drivers. They're subject to change based on a whole bunch of other different factors, which are outside the individual creator's control. And looking at it through a fashion lens from that point of view, how many designers before have said, I wish I could sidestep the existing system. I wish I could sidestep the existing supply chain. I wish I could sidestep some of these existing models. There's an opportunity here to create a new way of thinking that sort of realizes that. I'd like to talk a bit about blockchains and specifically NFTs for a minute, because I think almost everybody would agree that there's still considerable barriers to entry for consumers. We've just talked about interoperability, portability, the importance of owning something independent of platform owners. But I'm thinking more here at the user experience level, where you have software wallets and distributed apps that currently clash with what the average shopper is going to expect in terms of usability. Is there, like, for want of a better word, is there a way for blockchain applications to become more approachable in a way that's going to increase the chances of end user adoption?
Oh, yes, 100%. And I think that goes back to being part of the beginning of that journey, that in terms of like blockchain technology, even though we are now over 10 years within the game, it still is all very early stage. And I think it's just a matter of time, just like we experienced with Web 1 and Web 2, it's just a matter of time until interfaces, applications, user journeys become better and friendlier. And at this point in time, you know, none of us internet users are discussing things like TCP/IP. Like, this is not part of our conversation anymore. So I think, you know, as technology evolves, things thankfully start becoming invisible, because technology becomes beautiful. So we can stop preoccupying about certain things. So I think it's just a matter of time until these processes become better. And that's, you know, something that at Luxo, the reason why Fabian and I started Luxo is because truly we wanted to have an impact and an influence about how, you know, users are interacting with the blockchain and how the user journey is kind of like constitute and design. And by no means compromising decentralization, right? Because I think right now what we have is we have a series of applications that potentially, for the sake of simplifying the journey, they're sacrificing in decentralization, right? So it becomes slightly more centralized systems. So I think we have to find a way in which users can still like have that autonomy and authority and all of those beautiful things blockchain technology can provide but at the same time having a very easy user journey, right? The reason why right now user journeys are broken is because you have a very specific group of people developing the technology, right? At the beginning, you have very, you know, hardcore C++ code developers, cryptographers developing the technology, and poor, we're evolving to having more web developers coming in and more product people like myself coming in, and then truly coming in with an user-centric kind of like perspective. And I think it's just a matter of time until we simplify it, right? But most things that we're interacting in a regular basis are quite complex. But we as users, we are kind of like unaware of the complexity that stands behind it. And at this point in time, unfortunately, because the user journeys are broken, we need to be like those facilitators for ourselves as users. So I think those barriers of entry were lower, you know, at Luxo. So we are doing a lot of work around kind of like how user profiles, and we call it the universal profile, works for a user on chain, how assets are being created, how to truly create those standards and interfaces for creators and users so they can interact with the blockchain in a very simple fashion. So I think things like that obviously will simplify. And also obviously with the beautiful thing with blockchain technology is obviously there's always this part that we have this ability of having this internet of value that we always talk about. So we have this very thin line that we are like between, you know, technology and regulation of financial instruments simultaneously, right? So for certain things where you, for example, will require LIPS or ETH or Bitcoin and things like that in order to operate with the system, then you enter a process that is like a financial process in which you need to do KYCs and things like that. So I think just like everything eventually will become a service and will be productized. You know, we will have people providing for relayer services in which they will start paying. You know, you will pay a subscription and then this provider is paying for your transaction fees and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we will start having services built on top that will simplify the journey. But it's just a matter of timing. And I think we shouldn't be intimidated by it. And just, you know, we just continue to move forward and making sure that we are building better and more attractive applications.
There's a need for people to accept like a layer of abstraction between the fundamentals of something and the experience of using something. Like as somebody who grew up messing around with like, you said TCP/IP, somebody who grew up messing around with subnet masks and stuff like that. I'm very glad I don't have to do that anymore. I'm very glad I can just connect to a Wi-Fi network and things work out fine. And at no point do I feel as though I've necessarily lost control of what's underneath it. It's more a case of what portions of it do I actually need to interact with to get done what I need to get done. And I think the same is going to apply for the end user experiences here. It's a question of maturity, sure, but it's a question of how that maturity places those sort of layers of abstraction, service layers between the technology and between the experience.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, as we remember the beginnings of the web, like when the web, I mean, we do, not everybody, but, you know, some of us do. And there was this point where people were asking you, but what is it? And what do you do in it? And but how does it work? And it's very complex. I mean, the web is not any, you know, it's not by no means like an easier technology, right? So it's not that it became easier. It's just that we are, you know, or people stop being interested. It's that all of a sudden the value proposition was proven. What I can do is pretty straightforward, right? How the whole infrastructure behind it works. Very few people really know it. And I think when a new technology comes around, there's this necessity to understand what is it. If I cannot really use it and it's not very clear, I at least want to understand it. So I think this is kind of like like the dichotomy in a way that we are finding ourselves. So I think as applications become better, as the value proposition is indisputable for users, then that extreme necessity of understanding what's happening in the background will decrease. Not that I'm saying human curiosity should be shut down, but I think it's just that it's just in terms of like when we have an amazing application that we can utilize is way better than we now trying to, you know, become cryptographers in a free time.
It's very similar to the paradigm you have in a lot of end user applications where you have pro users / power users and you have regular users. And where you're at with, or where a lot of blockchain is at, is very much on the power user, pro user side at the minute. And what we're moving towards is more of that average user accessibility. That brings us to a similar question, but from the brand's perspective. So based on the conversations that I've had, well, we've had with brands recently, there's sort of a universal understanding of some of the potential benefits of blockchain-backed, NFT-backed digital fashion, but a lot less in the way of a kind of roadmap that allows a brand to actually achieve those benefits. Whether they're talking about selling digital fashion, you know, targeting the secondary market, or overhauling their supply chain relationships with smart contracts. In your experience, where are brands kind of encountering barriers to blockchain adoption, and what can be done about those barriers?
I think for brands entering the space, there is no barriers. Like there's nothing stopping them. I think there are kind of like challenges in terms of if you are a traditional brand, I think you have competitively a disadvantage based on the fact that you have all of the established processes and products and stuff and your supply chain and everything that you do in the physical world. I almost feel like it's extra weight at certain points in terms of moving into the space. But there's nothing really stopping it. And I think the challenge is, number one, well, you have an existing business model that, you know, is the one that so far has worked, but eventually you might have to deprioritize in order to prioritize something else. But that's kind of like very long-term. That's very similar to, I don't know, like the automotive industry, how easy, or let's say easier, is for a company like Tesla, Lucid Dreams, and any of those companies to fully start a completely new process of just manufacturing electric cars versus an existing company like, I don't know, Mercedes-Benz, to like now fully transform like their supply chain to now just produce electric cars. Like it's there's a challenge is bigger for them than it is for a completely new company, right? So a new company is more agile. So I think for existing fashion companies, there is a challenge that they already have a business model that is to the world that we're heading, it potentially is outdated, right? And these potential human resources, financial interests, and all of that continue to push in that direction, whereas they need to really put attention where the world is actually heading. So I think that's kind of like, I would say challenge number one. Then the actual, what I will say as a brand, if I would be an existing fashion brand, my main concern would be, does my brand has a value proposition that translates into an immaterial brand? And if that's so, what it is? And will my brand at all translate, right? Because a lot of the value propositions of these brands have nothing to do, it's very attached to the physical world. So it's a question, will it translate? And then if it translates, then I think it's a matter of executing the strategy so it's done properly. And then attracting the right talent. I think we're living in a point in time where, you know, talent, it is scarce. People who understand the space, who understand the culture are limited. And, you know, there is a question if those people are incentivized to work for a brand or start building something for their own. And I will argue they should build their own. So I think there's a series of challenges in that, but that's more like from a different perspective. From a technology perspective, that there is no challenges, right? There's some difficulties in terms of like onboarding your existing user through a user journey that is very not friendly for a regular consumer. But there's a lot of companies such as Luxo and the Materialize and many companies out there working on making that easier. To onboard your users, right? And I think another challenge might be that in that process of translating the brand, you seem inauthentic to your current user. So I think there's a lot of challenges that need to be navigated. I personally see from a technology perspective, I don't see challenges because I think the technology is out there already. It is not ready. It's not like a plug and play, but all of the pieces of the puzzle are there. And then you just need the right team to put them together.
Let's talk a little bit about digital identities. We all have them. And even though the bulk of this sort of pandemic era disruption to travel and work is hopefully over, we're also all more tied to sort of digital methods of interaction and expression than ever before. I mean, you and I are not recording this episode in the same room. We're recording this virtually. But on the flip side, there's a lot of deep concerns out there around how much of our digital identities we actually own and control, whether we're talking about persistent identities for the metaverse or less ephemeral things like data privacy and security. What role do you think self-sovereign, so self-owned, self-governed digital identities have to play in that in the near future? And what does it look like to actually put that into practice?
Well, I think, you know, as we continue to progress in this, I don't know, in this journey that we have embarked as a collective and as a society, in terms of, you know, there is a significant part of our lives that has been dematerialized, and it's, you know, how we understand value and assets and products or services, it's fundamentally different than what it meant for generations prior to ours. There is a bigger question around like what does it mean to have an identity in a world? And so far, we always understand identities in terms like our state-given birthright identity, which is governed by the rules of a state. And, you know, it has very specific functions that allow us to operate in the world. But we do a lot of things and a lot of activities that are unrelated, and we exist in a world that is a government agnostic, right? And the metaverse, it is and it should be and continue to be government agnostic and not be, controlled by the dynamics of geopolitics. So in that place, we do need an identity that is not related to our state-given identity. It's a completely new identity that is a software identity. And me as a gamer, as an entrepreneur, as a creator, as somebody who studied architecture, I have many facets of my life, and I might have several identities in the metaverse to express my different interests in different ways and create my identities in different ways. But those identities are all me, right? Yeah. And at all times, those identities should be under my control. Unfortunately, in the physical world, I am limited by the things that were given to me based on the place of my birth or when my parents were born or whatever it might be, and my gender and all of that stuff. There's a lot of limitations and boxes we've been put as humans, but we have now this opportunity of this new realm that we're building in which we can actually be and express all of the interests that we have outside of certain restrictions we might be facing in the physical world. So I think that identity and those identities, we will be using them way more than we do our passports, hopefully. And it's very, very important for us to be in control of them. And I think, you know, in the past when we started Luxo, we used to joke, Fabian and I, that we are solving problems that people don't know they have yet. I think users are waking to the realization that there's a true problem with centralization, especially when most of the activities that you realize online can be taken away from you. Like Google, Meta, all of these services can lock us out. And that's a very, very difficult thing to accept, but it's the truth. So I think we realize we need to move away from it. We need control. We need to be sovereign. We need to be in control of our identity. No, not saying they won't be monetized, but at least you have to agree to the monetization. We understand also that, you know, by these systems getting to know us, there might be a benefit in terms like of your music algorithm, knowing what you like and discovering things for you. It's a very nice experience, but you should be in control and understanding what is the trade-off. And I think as users, once we become aware of what is the trade-off, then those trade-offs might be okay. We can decide if we accept them or not, but it's a matter of we accepting them. So understanding that one of the most key parts of our existence moving forward, it will be the ability of controlling our digital identity is paramount.
I think that's interesting from a brand's perspective, though, because that does imply an evolution in the way that brands think about engagement with their consumers and engagement with the people who engage in return with them. Because currently that's very much sort of a one-way street where the brand is trying to bring in customers and maximize the lifetime value of those customers by selling them progressive products over time based on what they like. And currently the assumption there is that you are, within sort of GDPR regulations and everything else, you're opening yourself up as a consumer to being marketed at and to having your data used to roll into things like, to look at this through a fashion lens, to roll into things like planning of the next cycle of products, planning a future collection based on demographic data, all those kinds of things. I think the fundamental difference, if I understand it correctly, is that self-sovereign identities are more a case of having to explicitly grant that permission and having to explicitly opt in to be part of that cycle because you find it valuable. So that sort of shifts the onus a little bit towards the brands demonstrating that they can provide that sort of value. And that value can come in a ton of different forms and a ton of different types of experiences. But I think that's the sort of switch that you're talking about, is from kind of implicit value towards more explicit and optional opt-in value for the consumer.
100%.
The fashion industry's been physical only for centuries, right? It's an industry that sells physical products. Now, very suddenly, the brands are realizing the opportunity that lies in having a separate digital business model or a supplemental digital business model. Is that the right way for a brand to think about this? Should they be thinking of having a physical business unit and a separate digital business unit, or are the two more closely intertwined? You know, people throw the word digital out there. Is that the way brands should be thinking, or should they be thinking of having two separate strands here?
I think for the time being, we're going to have it as two separate strands. I think it just will be, you will have two separate departments with two different kind of like skill sets, and you will have it separate. In my opinion, though, I think those things are not separate. You know, you don't have, or maybe they do, but I think when, you know, as a brand, you just have outputs, right? Like you produce, I don't know, apparel and then shoes and accessories and whatever, you produce products. And then potentially you might have different creative directors, or you will have one that creative director for all of them. But at the end, it's the product of the brand. And I think with digital products, it's not any different. It's not like this extra thing that you do on the side. That is kind of how it's happening now for reasons that is obvious, and it might be fine. But in the long term, it's just one of your products as a brand, right? And it's not this other thing that you are doing. So it should be, in my opinion, 100% integrated within the vision of the brand, and it's not separate. I think when we talk about digitals and physical products and only digital products, I think they're just manifestations of the ethos of the brand and should be understood as such. I think I have said this many times before, but I do believe it's still very, very current when it comes to a physical products. I think there is no way specifically for like higher tier or like higher price point products, I think there is no way for those products to continue to exist without having a digital identity. And those products without a digital identity will be just like having an iPhone without battery. It's a beautiful product. There's just nothing for you. So it's, you know, like fashion goes beyond just utility, right? That's why there are other brands in the world besides Jack Wolfskin and the North Face, is because it's not all about utility. There's a lot of reasons why we consume fashion. So that part of that experience, that access and belonging and all of those beautiful things that we want to enter and that we desire when we enter in a relationship with a brand, those things can be facilitated even better through digital products and physical products which have a digital identity. So I think, you know, as we continue to move forward, percentage-wise, it's very likely that the market share for digital products is substantially larger and bigger than the market share for physical products. I think that's a future that is unavoidable, and we know it. Just like, you know, 30 years ago, all of the biggest companies in the world were all oil companies. And today, all the bigger companies in the world are tech companies. So it's just a natural evolution. So I think, you know, in that process, it might become, as it will become a bigger part of your market share, then those themes will become more relevant. But I think as a brand, you have to be consistent about who you are. And therefore, any product, doesn't matter that it's physical or digital, it should come from the same vision, and therefore those things should be heavily intertwined.
There will be a good amount of brands who are looking at digital fashion as a much higher margin opportunity than physical fashion, just because something that is, it's going to be scarce, or to a certain degree, it might be scarce in different tiers, but it doesn't actually have a manufacturing cost associated with it. It has a design cost, it might have a minting cost, things like that. But there's the potential there to achieve much higher margins on these kinds of things. That doesn't mean that it's just an easy switch to flip, to just go from selling physical versions of something to selling high volume, high margin digital assets, because it's a very different business model. It's a very different value proposition, and it's a very different brand positioning. And what you're talking about there, the consistency of making sure that what you produce digitally and physically both resonates with the brand, that seems to be the main sort of driving factor and the main driving decision behind this, is does it make sense for you as a brand to do this, and can you make it work in a way that's consistent with what people expect from you?
Yeah, exactly.
That brings us to the end of the show. Now, if you enjoyed that discussion, I'm going to be unpacking and analyzing some similar themes live on stage at Sourcing at Magic in Las Vegas this August, alongside Dr. Eric S. Ackerman of Perry Ellis International. They were early movers into the metaverse, and what Perry Ellis learned has a lot to teach other brands who want to make the most of the metaverse and the most of digital fashion opportunities. Visit www.sourcingitmagic.com to sign up for the show, either live or virtually, for the next stage in this discussion. Thanks again to the Informer Markets Fashion and the Sourcing It Magic teams for sponsoring this episode. We hope to see you at the show, and I look forward to welcoming you back to another episode of the Interline podcast soon.